Hey everybody, Tiffany Georgopoulos here, and I want to start with a question that I think a lot of people have been asking themselves lately. Why does it feel like everything going on in the world is connected to oil? And not just gas prices at the pump, I mean everything. From Venezuela, Iran, the Strait of Hormuz, the US dollar, inflation, geopolitical tensions, and places that most people couldn't even point to on a map a few years ago. It feels like oil keeps showing up at the center of every major story. And yet most people still think of it as just a commodity, or just a thing to fuel your car. But here's what I want to show you today. Oil is not just a commodity, oil is power. And once you start seeing it that way, once you understand why nations fight over it, why financial systems were literally built around it, and why its control shapes the outcome of entire economies, it starts making a lot more sense. In my last video, I talked about the two systems that are quietly competing for dominance in the global economy. On one side, it's a model of power built on controlling the financial system, like currencies, banks, trade networks, etc. On the other hand, it's a model built on controlling physical things, like energy, metals, food, manufacturing, and more. Today, we're going deeper into that framework, because if there's one resource that sits at the absolute center of that conflict, one resource that every major power on Earth is maneuvering around right now, you guessed it, it's oil. And by the end of this video, I think you'll see why. Enter section one, why oil is power. So why does oil matter so much? Simple answer, the global economy still runs on it. Despite everything you've heard about renewables and the energy transition, oil and natural gas still make up the majority of global energy consumption. Transportation runs on oil, manufacturing runs on oil, agriculture, the food on your plate runs on oil. Supply chains that move goods across continents and oceans run on oil. Even the push towards renewables requires oil. The equipment to build wind turbines and solar panels, all transported by oil power ships and trucks. The plastics, the lubricants, the synthetic materials, all derived from oil. So when we talk about energy as a value sector, we're not talking about a niche investment theme. We're talking about the foundational layer underneath the entire global economy. And here's what makes this especially interesting right now. For years, ESG mandates, activist investors, and regulatory pressure pushed energy companies to pull back on new investment. And many of them did. That created underinvestment. Fewer new projects, fewer new fields, a thinner pipeline of future supply, and demand did not go away. So the supply side of oil is now structurally constrained. And not because we've run out of oil in the ground, but because the infrastructure to bring it to the market hasn't kept pace. And for the easiest, most productive fields, many are already past their peak, and new production is more expensive, more complex, and more politically complicated. And that's not a short-term disruption. That's a structural shift. And it's one of the biggest reasons energy remains one of the most important sectors for investors right now. Enter section two, how oil is priced and why it's political from the start. Before we get into it all, I want to make sure we're all on the same page about something that may be new for a lot of people. Oil is not priced locally, it's priced globally. There are two major benchmarks you'll hear about. The first is Brent crude. That's the international standard. It reflects global supply and demand. The second is West Texas Intermediate, or WTI. That's the primary benchmark used in the United States. And here's what surprises people. Even in the United States, which produces a significant amount of its own oil, gas prices are more closely tied to Brent rather than WTI. Why? Because oil is a globally traded commodity. It flows across borders, it gets brought and sold in international markets, and that means even if the US is producing oil domestically, American consumers are still subject to global price dynamics, which then leads to something really important. The United States imports a lot of its oil from Canada, not the Middle East, and it produces a substantial portion domestically. So in terms of physical supply, you could argue the US has a degree of energy independence. But independence from global pricing, that's a different story, because oil prices are set in a global market, and that global market is deeply, fundamentally political. Enter section three, the politics of oil and the petrodollar system. This is where it gets really interesting, and this is where I want to bring back the two systems framework that I talked about in my last video. Because here's the thing, The reason oil is so central to global power isn't just because everyone needs it. It's because of how it's been priced for the last 50 years. Since 1971, after the United States moved off the gold standard, the dollar needed a new foundation, and that foundation became oil. Through agreements with Saudi Arabia and other major producers, the world settled into a system where oil was priced and traded in U.S. dollars. This became known as the petrodollar system. And the implications of that are enormous. If every country in the world needs dollars to buy oil, the most essential commodity on the planet, then every country in the world needs to hold dollars. They need to participate in the dollar-based financial system. They need to buy U.S. Treasury bonds. And that demand? That's where U.S. financial power comes from. It's what allows the United States to run large deficits. It's what keeps interest rates lower than they'd otherwise be. It's what makes the dollar the world's reserve currency. So to put it simple, oil didn't just fuel cars. Oil fueled the dominance of the American financial system. That's the system on the financial side, the one built on controlling how money flows. But now, something is shifting. Enter Section 4. The cracks in the petrodollar system, seen through examples like the Strait of Hormuz and the Chinese yuan. If you're watching or reading any news recently, then you've seen the headlines about the Strait of Hormuz. For those who aren't familiar, Hormuz is a narrow waterway less than 25 miles wide at its narrowest point that connects the Persian Gulf to the open ocean. And through that corridor flows roughly one-fifth of the world's entire oil supply, around 20 million barrels per day. Think about that for a second. One narrow passage, one-fifth of global oil. If that passage were disrupted, markets wouldn't wait because the physical supply of the world's most important commodity would suddenly be in question. But here's a development that's gotten less attention than it deserves. There are reports that Iran has been demanding that ships transiting near its waters pay tolls, and not in US dollars, but in Chinese yuan. Now, you could look at that and say, okay, maybe that's just one country making a political statement, or you could look at it and recognize what it represents, a direct challenge to the petrodollar system. Because if the world's most critical oil choke point starts operating in yuan instead of dollars, even partially, that chips away at the foundational logic of dollar dominance. And Iran is not alone in this. China has been building out what's called the petro-yuan, which is an attempt to settle oil trades in its own currency. There's the CIPS payment system, which is the Chinese alternative to SWIFT, and BRICS nations have been actively exploring Project Enbridge and other mechanisms to reduce their dependence on the dollar-based financial infrastructure. And this is not just a conspiracy theory. This is openly documented policy. The countries on the physical resources side of that two systems divide, the ones whose power comes from what they produce, not from controlling financial networks, they're actively working to reduce the dollar's grip. And oil is the leverage point, because oil is what gives the dollar its global necessity in the first place. Enter Section 5, the debt side of the equation. Now here's where it gets a little uncomfortable, and I think it's important to be honest about this. The petrodollar system has allowed the United States to borrow at a scale that wouldn't otherwise be possible. And over decades, that borrowing has compounded. The concern that a growing number of economists and strategists are raising is this. What happens when the demand for US dollars and US Treasury bonds starts to decline? Because if fewer countries need dollars to buy oil, they need fewer dollars overall. And if they need fewer dollars, they buy fewer Treasury bonds. And if Treasury demand falls, interest rates have to rise to attract buyers. Higher interest rates mean higher borrowing costs for the government, for businesses, for consumers. And here's the uncomfortable part. When you're already carrying an enormous amount of debt, higher rates don't just slow things down, they accelerate the problem. You need to borrow more just to pay the interest on what you already owe. Some analysts describe this dynamic as something called the debt doom loop, where rising rates force more borrowing, which puts more pressure on rates, which then forces more borrowing, and so on. It's a cycle that's hard to exit once it gains momentum. Now, I'm not here to tell you the dollar is going to collapse tomorrow, because that's not the point, and that's not going to happen. The point is, the financial system that's been built on top of oil is starting to show stress. And the countries that are driving that stress are doing so deliberately because they know that whoever controls the energy controls the leverage. That's the two systems playing out in real time. Enter Section 6, Venezuela and how they use oil as currency and oil as alliance. Let me give you one of the clearest real-world examples of what happens when oil becomes more than just an economic asset. Venezuela. It sits on some of the largest proven oil reserves in the world, larger than Saudi Arabia by some estimates, and yet for the last decade, the country has experienced one of the most severe economic collapses in modern history. Some of that was internal, like mismanagement, political instability, and poor policy decisions. But a significant part of the story was also external, like sanctions cut Venezuela off from the Western financial system. Access to dollar-based banking and to international credit markets, and that access narrowed dramatically. But here's what happened next, and this is the part that directly connects to our two systems framework. Venezuela did not disappear from the global economy. It adapted. When the financial door closed, the physical door opened. Oil became currency. Oil became the mechanism for maintaining alliances, keeping trade flowing, and preserving influence in a world where traditional financial channels were no longer available. Venezuela deepened relationships with Russia, Iran, and China, which are all countries that were facing similar financial restrictions and had every incentive to build alternative systems. Oil got shipped through channels that operated outside normal tracking systems, payments were made in non-dollar currencies, commodities were exchanged directly, so in other words, when financial access tightens, physical resources carry the weight. And this is not unique to Venezuela. It's a pattern. Anywhere political pressure increases and financial restrictions tighten, you see the same dynamic emerge. The countries that have physical resources like energy, metals, food, continue to find ways to keep trading. The asset itself becomes the medium of exchange. That's the physical system asserting itself against the financial one yet again. And when you see it happen in Venezuela, and then you look at what's happening at Hormuz, and then you look at what China is building with the petro-yuan, geez, guys, I'm hoping by now you are realizing these aren't isolated stories. They're the same story playing out in different places at the same time. Enter Section 7, supply, demand, and why the market is tight. Let's bring this back to market fundamentals for a moment. Global demand for oil continues to grow, and not in the United States or Western Europe necessarily, but in developing economies, in Asia, in Africa, in regions with expanding populations and industrializing economies that are building the same infrastructure that we built decades ago. They need energy to do that. And right now, that energy mostly comes from oil and gas. At the same time, supply growth is limited. Years of underinvestment created a thinner pipeline of new projects. Geopolitical instability in the Middle East and Eastern Europe and other key producing regions, it all creates uncertainty that makes companies reluctant to commit capital to long-term projects. The result is what analysts call a structurally tight market. Supply is struggling to keep pace with demand, and in that environment, even small disruptions can have outsized effects on price. We're not running out on oil. I want to be clear about that. The physical resource still exists, but the easy oil like large, shallow, cheap to extract fields that drove the last century of growth, much of that has already been developed. What's left is more expensive, more technically challenging, more politically complicated, and in some cases located in places that are increasingly contested. The issue isn't scarcity in an absolute sense. It's a scarcity of accessible and affordable supply. And that distinction matters enormously when you're trying to understand long-term price dynamics. Enter Section 8, oil volatility and why it moves so fast. Now, something a lot of people notice but don't fully understand is how volatile oil prices can be. Why does it sometimes move 5, 10, 15% in a matter of days? There's a few reasons, but if I gave you all of them, it would take the whole day. So let me simplify it into three parts. First, geopolitics. Oil is produced in some of the most politically unstable regions on Earth. A conflict in the Middle East, a decision by OPEC to cut production, a sanctions package that takes supply off the market. Any of these can shift the global supply picture pretty quickly. Second, OPEC itself, which is the organization of the petroleum exporting countries. It's essentially like a cartel, a group of major producers that coordinate on output levels to influence prices. When OPEC decides to cut production, supply drops. When they decide to increase it, supply rises. Markets react accordingly. Third, market sentiment. Oil futures are traded by an enormous number of participants. not just oil companies, but hedge funds, banks, commodity traders. Sentiment and speculation can amplify price moves that fundamentals might not fully justify. Put those three things together, so geopolitical risk, supply coordination by a powerful cartel, and speculative trading, and you have a recipe for frequent, sharp price movements. For investors, that volatility is both a risk and an opportunity, and understanding where it comes from is the first step to navigating it. Enter Section 9, the bigger picture of the two systems and oil as a specific resource. So let's connect all of this together, because what we've been talking about this entire video, like inflation, petrodollars, Hormuz, Venezuela, supply and demand, it all flows back to that same framework I laid out in my last video. Two systems, one built on financial power and one built on physical production. And oil sits at the intersection of both. For 50 years, oil was financial power. The petrodollar system fused the two together. Controlling oil meant controlling currency demand. Controlling currency demand meant controlling the financial system. But that fusion is starting to loosen. Countries on the physical side, like Russia, China, Iran, Venezuela, and others, are actively building infrastructure to trade oil outside the dollar system. And not all at once, not overnight, but deliberately and consistently. And as that happens, the balance between the two systems shifts. The country that controls energy doesn't just control an economic input. It controls leverage over allies, over adversaries, over the global financial system itself. That's why the United States cares about what happens at the Hormuz, even though it imports most of its oil from Canada. Because global oil prices affect the American economy regardless of where American oil comes from. That's why Venezuela matters. It's a case study in how physical resources become geopolitical tools when financial systems are weaponized. That's why the petro-yuan matters, not because it's going to replace the dollar, but because it's representing a systematic effort to separate the world's most important commodity from the world's dominant currency. Oil is political. It has always been political. But right now, the politics of oil are reshaping the architecture of the global economy in ways that most people haven't fully processed yet. Enter Section 10. So where's the opportunity? If oil is becoming more strategic, if physical resources are becoming more important, if the geopolitical shifts we've been talking about are real and ongoing, how do you position yourself to participate in what that means for markets? Here's the thing. Large energy companies, the majors, the household names, they've already moved. After the run-up in oil prices in recent years, a lot of the upside has already been priced into those stocks. But that's not where we focus. At Natural Resource Stocks, our focus is on smaller companies, junior companies, small-cap natural resource producers and explorers. And here's why that distinction matters. Smaller companies are less followed by analysts. They're less efficiently priced. They don't have the same institutional coverage, which means when you find a company that's sitting on real assets, real reserves, real production potential, the market often hasn't fully valued it yet. These companies are also more sensitive to commodity prices. When oil moves up meaningfully, a junior energy producer doesn't just benefit a little. It can benefit a lot, because the economics of a small producer can transform dramatically with relatively modest changes in the prices of the underlying commodity. And there's another dynamic that's specific to junior natural resource companies that I think is really important to understand. Large energy companies need to replace their reserves constantly. As they produce oil, their existing reserves decline. And at some point, the most efficient way to replace those reserves isn't to explore from scratch, it's to acquire a smaller company that's already found something. That creates a steady pipeline of merger and acquisition activity in the junior space. And for investors in junior companies, that M&A potential is a meaningful part of the upside story. You're not just betting on oil prices to go up, you're also positioning yourself as a potential acquisition target for a larger company that needs what the junior company has. So when you put it all together, the structural underinvestment in energy, the tight supply and demand balance, the geopolitical forces driving resource control up the priority list for governments everywhere, and the specific dynamics that make junior companies attractive within the landscape, you start to see why this is where we focus. Because the macro story we've been building throughout this video, two systems competing, oil at the center, physical resources becoming more strategic, that story eventually shows up in markets. And the best place to find value before the broader market has caught up to the structural shift is often in the smaller, less followed corners of the resource sector. So going back to the very beginning, we started today by asking a simple question. Why does everything seem to connect back to oil? And what I hope you could see now is that the answer is way bigger than most people realize. Oil is not just fuel, it's a foundation. It undermines how economies function, how financial systems were built, and how geopolitical power gets exercised. The petrodollar system fused oil and financial dominance together for 50 years, but that system is under pressure now. From countries building alternative payment networks, from the gradual erosion of the dollar-based oil trading, from the physical realities of a tight supply market in a world where demand isn't going anywhere, and the countries that understand and see oil not just as energy source, but as a strategic asset, as leverage, as a tool for building alliances and shaping outcomes. Those are the countries that are most aggressively positioning themselves right now. That's the two systems at work. The financial side trying to preserve its influence while the physical side trying to expand its autonomy. And in the middle of it all is oil, the most political commodity in the world, the most important resource of the last century, and I'd argue one of the most important lenses for understanding what's happening in the world right now. At Natural Resource Stocks, that's what we're here to help you see. We look beneath the headlines and find out what's actually going on. For Natural Resource Stocks, I'm Tiffany Georgopoulos, and I'll see you next time. All right, guys, thank you so much for watching. And if you enjoyed this video, please hit that like button down below. And if you want to learn more about natural resources, junior mining companies, or geopolitics and more, hit that subscribe button below, and I promise you, you will stay updated. We also have our Natural Resource Stocks Expo in Atlanta, Georgia on May 1st and 2nd, where we'll have Michael Gentile, Andy Scheckman, Tom Luongo, and potentially Alex Craner scheduled to speak and give roundtable discussions on investing in gold, silver, junior mining stocks, and the current state of geopolitics and global affairs. So if you're an accredited investor and would like to talk with the different CEOs of some of the leading mining companies in the industry, use the link below to register, and I'll see you in Atlanta. Bye, y'all.